This is Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith.
If the trucks don't come every single night bringing more food, what will happen in one of those giant cities? You know, if the trucks are prevented by a fuel crisis or a local war or something, you will have starvation within a week in those giant cities.
What kind of fringe alarmist warns us about the coming global famine? Actually, he's one of the big voices from Australia. Julian Cribb has published over 7,000 articles and written or edited 8 books. He's won 32 awards as a journalist and held prestigious positions in several institutions. He's an influential Australian, to say the least. Julian Cribb, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Thank you, Alex.
You've had an eye on agriculture for many years. Last spring, you warned of a developing crisis in the food supply. Was that because of the drought in the best farming regions of Australia, or was it a larger picture that pushed you?
It was the larger picture that pushed me. I mean, as you say, I've been watching what's been going on in agriculture worldwide, and I've been aware for many years that we haven't been reinvesting in agricultural science and technology like we used to do in the 1970s. I mean, basically, the world population has doubled since that time, but our emphasis on agricultural science has dwindled. That was worrying me. But then I began to look at the other factors, like, you know, have we got enough water? Have we got enough land? What are we going to do when oil becomes scarce or very expensive? And when you start to put it together, it becomes clear that feeding the human species through this huge peak in numbers and demand of the mid-century is going to be a very challenging thing indeed.
Population growth does seem central to your argument. I heard your speech as a podcast from the University of Melbourne, and you talked about projections of 9 to 12 billion people. And, you know, my inner voice resisted that. I think, well, that'll never happen. Some disease or war will stop it. But I think maybe we all have a denial mechanism for population, just like we do for climate change. We don't want it to happen, so we think it won't. Do you run into that?
Yes, I mean, people are reluctant to understand the realities of population growth. But, you know, it's not just the realities of population growth. It's the fact that every single one of us, when we open our mouths and put food in them, we are eating vastly more energy, more water, more resources than we ever ate before in human history. So the world food demand is going to double, but that is partly due to population growth, but it's also partly due to the absolutely uncontrolled demand for food that we have in our fast-growing economies.
We're all eating more, and of course, many of the people of the world now want to eat more meat, and that requires a lot more resources. Is that the kind of thing you're talking about?
Absolutely, and the fact that we're trashing half our food. I mean, in America, in Australia, in Europe, and so on, half the food goes straight in the garbage. So we're producing a lot of food that we're not eating at all. So yes, we're eating far more, and hence you've got a global pandemic of obesity. And of course, you've got China and India exploring the delights of meat and dairy produce and so on for the first time, and they are of course ramping up their demand for protein-rich foods.
It's important to note that you're predicting regional famines and wars. Maybe other places will continue to feed their populations. Where would the food hotspots be?
Well, I think that the crisis areas are going to be mainly on the Indo-Gangetic Plains and the North China Plain, possibly also in Central Asia and the Middle East, and possibly also in North Africa and Sub-Saharan Africa. Those are the areas most likely to run out of food and to experience severe local famines. But the point about the book is to say that nobody in the world is going to be untouched by this, because we've already seen just this year how a drought in Russia caused corn prices to soar in the United States and affect prices for food in supermarkets. Everybody is going to be touched, at least in terms of the cost of food, by this. And of course, if there are refugee crises with refugees flooding all over the world and major conflicts arising, then we get affected that way too. So we need to be concerned about it. Famine is not something that happens in a faraway country and can't touch us any longer. It can touch us in very real ways.
Well, I'm really glad you brought that up. I mean, the United States is currently, they have 40 million people receiving food stamp aid, and the doctors are saying we're eating badly and subsisting on fat and sugar. And when you add in the rapidly increasing costs at the grocery store, I wonder, maybe a hidden famine is already developing, even in some allegedly wealthy countries. What would your thoughts on that be?
Well, there's certainly a great deal of inequity about food distribution, even in wealthy countries like the United States and Australia. Difficult problem to fix, of course. The thing we need to worry about, if there was a major famine breakout in Asia, for example, and food prices in the United States doubled, probably half the US population would be unable to afford it. So you would then see a very real impact on ordinary sort of middle-class Americans. So that's the kind of thing we need to worry about. It's the kind of thing we need to think about preventing. And it's caused primarily by the fact that, you know, we're stealing from farmers the things that they need to produce food. We're taking away their water. We're taking away their land. Oil is going to become very scarce over the next 10 years or so. Fertilizer is running out worldwide. It's going to take a while to run out, but it's running out. It's finite. We haven't invested in agricultural science like we should have done. The climate is changing, and that's making agricultural production much more unstable, more prone to drought and so on. And, of course, the oceans are running out of fish. So you add all these things together, you know, you start to see the scale of the problem that we're up against.
Yeah, fish is very important to the food chain for more than just eating the fish, which a lot of people do depend on, but also it's being used as a feed for animal stocks around the world, and we may run out of them, as you say.
Well, currently we eat about 100 million tons of wild-caught fish a year, and that's been stagnant for the last decade. We are not going to be able to double the fish catch from the oceans at the same time as world food demand doubles. So whatever happens, we're going to have to find 100 million tons more protein from land. Now, 100 million tons of protein means you're going to have to grow 1 billion tons of grain. And to grow 1 billion tons of grain, you need to discover one more North America. But you add to that the fact that meat consumption is rising worldwide in China and India, as we've discussed. FAO says we're going to increase meat consumption by 185 million tons. Well, that basically means that we would need to find 3 more North Americas in order to produce all of that protein by the mid part of this century using current techniques. So you can see that's just a way of putting in perspective the size of the challenge that we're up against. We've got to basically triple world protein production.
And a lot of this is in your book. Tell us about the title and what the book is about.
Well, I call it The Coming Famine, The World Food Crisis, and What We Can Do to Avoid It. And my take on it is that it's a world famine because no matter where it breaks out, and it's going to break out many times in the next 50 years, it's going to affect everybody, you know, in terms of food prices, in terms of political instability, trade instability, and so on. I do believe it's avoidable. I believe we can solve this problem if we farm and produce food in a much more sustainable fashion and we recycle our nutrients and we go to sustainable forms of energy for agriculture and so on. But I don't think we're focusing nearly hard enough on the problem at the moment in order to develop those solutions. So I think we're in for some nasty shocks before we actually solve the problem. However, I emphasize, I do believe it's soluble. I'm an optimist about, you know, the ability of human beings to deal with these kinds of issues.
This is Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith. We are talking about a possible collapse of the global food system in the coming decades. Our guest is the well-known Australian journalist and advisor Julian Cribb. Julian, right now, the United States and Europe, and I assume Australia, are sending millions of tons of food aid to Africa and Asia. Can that continue, and what happens if it stops?
Well, you know, it's just what we call a band-aid in Australia, a sticking plaster for the problem. The issue is that Africa and the developing world need to grow their own food. We produce more than enough food for them, but at the end of the day, we're not prepared to pay to have it shipped to all of it, to have it shipped to Africa and to be distributed and, you know, all the freezer trucks and the railways and things you'd have to build to distribute food in Africa. It's much more effective if Africans grow their own food, if Indians grow their own food, if Chinese grow their own food. And that means distributing knowledge, agricultural knowledge. But at the moment, I mean, there's 1.8 billion farmers worldwide. There's an awful lot of farmers. And getting the knowledge to them is a very inefficient sort of chain at the moment. We're not focusing on that either. We're doing lots of research. Well, not quite enough. But we're hardly focusing at all on the challenge of getting new knowledge, sustainable farming knowledge, into the hands of those 1.8 billion farmers. So that's an area that really needs to be tackled rather than thinking of America as a grain basket that's going to feed Africa, because frankly that's not going to happen. It hasn't happened in the last 40 years and it's probably not going to happen in the next 40.
You brought up the case of Russia that suffered a severe heat wave in the summer of 2010, and what they did was they stopped their international grain exports. Can you see that we will have in the future countries that just shut down the international food markets?
Oh, yes. I mean, if you go back to 2008, when world oil prices went to $160 a barrel and there was a crisis in rice worldwide and in other grains, countries like Vietnam and so on stopped exporting rice as well. These kinds of things, the first thing that a government does when it gets into one of those crises is to stop exports. And that, of course, destabilizes the world market and drives up the prices even higher. So it, in fact, makes the problem even worse. And this is the difficulty we're dealing with. We're dealing with governments who have got this very, very short-term view of agriculture. They wait until there is a crisis before they do anything. They don't plan to prevent the crisis. And that's the reason I've written the book, to say there are things we can do. There are lots of things we can do, but we're not thinking about those things. We're not taking the long-term view. We're just waiting for the crisis to happen.
And during the recent drought that happened in Australia, when there was a question of whether farmers should get the water or cities should get the water, it seems like a no-brainer that the residents of the cities are going to demand their water. We can see more of that coming up in the future.
Yeah, that's because we've got very stupid governments, and they think, well, Australia's a rich country, we sell all that iron ore to China, and we can afford to buy food from overseas. But in reality, this is an agriculturally rich country, and we should be supporting our own farmers first, and we should be encouraging them to be even more water efficient than they are. I mean, they are the world's most water efficient farmers. They grow more food with less water than anyone else on earth. But we need to supply them with the science and technology to help them do more of that. And by the way, that's what all farmers worldwide, in America and in everywhere, in Africa, are going to need over the coming 50, 60, 70 years as climate change hammers home. All farmers are going to be dealing with much more unpredictable climates, more droughts, more intense droughts, heavier deluges of rainfall that flood crops and things like that. So farmers are going to have to be much more flexible, and they're going to have a wider variety of crop types that they can grow to stand up to these intensifying climate hits. The area of the world's farmland is shrinking by 1% a year at current rates, and this means that by 2050, 2060, we will have less than half our current area of farmland if we don't stop this. Now, it's shrinking for two reasons. One, because it's being degraded by the economic pressures and others we're putting on our farmers. But two, it's shrinking because the cities are stealing the land from the farmers. And worldwide, by 2050, the footprint of the world's cities will occupy a land area equal to the size of China. And the footprint of those cities' recreational catchment, that's all the area they use for golf courses and recreational farms and things like that, hobby farms, that's going to occupy a land area equal to the size of the United States. And that's all on the world's best farmland, because it's all in river valleys where cities are, or coastal plains. So that's going to be subtracted from agriculture, making the whole of the agricultural system much more at risk, much more risky and unpredictable at a time when food supply is becoming more jeopardized. So we've got to think very hard before we just take up more land at the fringe of the city and turn it into urban blocks.
Oh, we see it all the time. People, farmers think, well, there's my multi-million dollar cash, I'll sell out, and we always rule with our bylaws in favor of putting more buildings, and yes, we must have parks and walkways and all the things that we demand in the city. So I don't know how we're going to stop that. Most of the world's population is moving into these megacities.
Well, the megacities will have populations of between 7 and 8 billion by the mid-century total. And some of those cities will be 20, 30, and 40 million people in size, and they will have almost no internal food capacity. So if the trucks don't come every single night bringing more food, what will happen in one of those giant cities? If the trucks are prevented by a fuel crisis or a local war or something, you will have starvation within a week in those giant cities. And it will be a horrendous scene. It'll be like, World War II, the end of World War II, the starvation that went on in Eastern Europe. And people are not aware of that the cities no longer support themselves food-wise. So we really need to redesign our cities so that they start recycling nutrients and water and producing more of their own food.
There is a small movement here in North America, transition towns and people who are trying to get communal gardens going in the cities and looking at rooftop gardening and all of that, but it's such a tiny little fleck. As you say, if the trucks stop running, I think people would just have to walk away from the cities possibly.
Well, where would they go? Of course, you know, the farmers will be waiting there trying to stop them getting into their crops. But, you know, you will have mass starvation in these great megacities, and you know, there will be almost nothing we can do. So that's the kind of food shock that I think that we will see before the world really wakes up to the extent of its peril. But as I say, it's totally preventable. Growing your own veggies is a great thing to do, but it's not going to solve the problem of feeding a city. We need to have an industrialized hydroponic systems and things like that that will produce enough fruit and vegetables to help the city get by.
Here in Canada, the Canadian military historian Gwyn Dyer, he's predicted serious wars, possibly even nuclear wars, if the global food trade fails. Have you put that into your book, the possibility of struggles and wars?
Yes, indeed I have. People have actually forgotten that food, land and water are at the root of most serious human disputes. If you peel away the superficial layers of conflict between different political groups or religious groups or ethnic groups, underneath you find people are arguing about food, land and water. I mean, Darfur, basically, is a war between farmers and cowboys. Rwanda started off as an argument between cattle graziers and farmers. Eritrea and the Horn of Africa is all about agricultural failure being enmeshed with war. Even the Balkans was a fight over that. We know the Russian Revolution and the French Revolution going further back in history. You know, both cases, governments were torn down by people who were starving and angry as a result of their starvation. So we know that famine leads to war, leads to governments being torn down. And that's Gwyn Dyer's hypothesis. It's based on sound thinking by the big military think tanks in Washington and in the UK and elsewhere and in Scandinavia. They're all saying the same thing. Food, land and water are primary drivers of conflict in this age. And if we want to avoid war, one way we can de-escalate the tensions is by ensuring that everyone is fed.
Peace through better farming. Julian Cribb, when do food shortages and famine get really serious in your view?
Well, in my view, what we're going to see is a number of shocks as we approach 2050, and each shock will be bigger than the last one if we don't take the kind of preventive actions that I'm outlining. I mean, as we say, we had the grain price shock in 2008. 2 years later, we've got a Russian drought shock. What are we going to have in 2012? I don't know, but it will be something. What is going to happen to food prices when oil prices go back to $160 or even $200 or $300 a barrel? I mean, when that happens, a lot of farmers are going to have to give up using tractors worldwide. I mean, so that's going to affect food prices directly. So it's not just climatic things that affect food prices, it's also these other scarcities. If there are scarcities in fertilizer supplies, and we've seen, you know, the Australian company BHP bidding for Canadian potash recently, well, they're not doing that because it's Be Kind to Farmers Week, they're doing that because they expect to get very rich, and they think that potash is going to be in scarce supply over the next 50 years, and they're making a bid to invest in the biggest producer in the world. So, you know, you can see that people are already speculating about these kinds of scarcities that are coming down. We need to do something about that. There are lots of things that we can do about it. I mean, in the case of potash and phosphorus, you can recycle the stuff that comes out the bottom end of cities. Instead of throwing our food in the garbage, we can recycle the nutrients. Instead of wasting our sewage effluent, we can recycle the nutrients. But we're not doing any of that at the moment, or very little of it.
And I know that in our school system, there isn't even a hint that anyone would want to become a farmer. So it seems like we need a social reorganization to appreciate where our food comes from again.
Well, two things. I think that to feed the human race in 2050, 2060, we're probably going to have to do two things. One, we're going to have to revolutionize the way we produce food in the ways that I'm outlining in the book. Secondly, we're also going to have to ask human beings to eat at a slightly lower level. That means perhaps doubling the amount of vegetables in the diet and halving the amount of meat and high protein. That would be good for us, by the way, because, I mean, our current Western diet kills a half of all consumers. You know, they're dying of heart disease, cancer, diabetes, obesity, and all of that sort of, all those different degenerative diseases. So to eat a bit lighter and to eat more vegetables would actually help them live longer and would also reduce the massive blowout in healthcare costs in every single Western country in the world. The healthcare cost is the leading budget item these days. So eating more healthily will help conserve the resource base, which grows our food worldwide. It will also make us healthier people, and it will reduce the cost burdens on our economy. So it makes sense from a number of perspectives. But how do you do that? Well, my suggestion is that we put a year of food into every junior school on the planet, in which every subject that you teach at school is taught through the lens of food. So when you study maths, you study food. When you study science, you study how plants grow and animals reproduce and things like that. When you study sport, you learn about diet and fitness and things like that. So that you're imbued with much more respect and understanding for food when you come out of your junior school year than you had when you went into it. And I think that's the only way we're going to wake people up. We're going to have something that's fairly universal. But it's easy to do. I mean, food is acceptable in all cultures and creeds.
You've brought up so many important threads there. Is there a website for your book?
Well, there's only the website at the University of California Press where the book is being marketed. I have a website called World Food Crisis, which I run mainly science stories of people who are trying to address this problem, and that's at www.sciencealert.com.au/worldfoodcrisis.
And give us the name of your book one more time.
It's The Coming Famine, The World Food Crisis, and What We Can Do to Avoid It.
I'll put that in my blog, so that'll make it easy for people to find. If people go to ecoshock.info and look for the blog for this radio show, you'll find a good link right there. Well, there you have it from Down Under, the Australian communicator and thought leader, I say, Julian Cribb. Thank you, sir. It's been an honor to have you on Radio EcoShock.
Thank you very much, Alex.
Check out the Radio EcoShock website. We're at ecoshock.org.
Hello, I'm Alex Smith with a serious question for you. What if the past determines our future? Are we humans headed for success or lasting economic depression, perhaps on an overheated planet? Dr. Timothy Garrett is Associate Professor of Atmospheric Sciences at the University of Utah. In February 2010, Tim joined us on Radio EcoShock to discuss his disturbing new scientific paper. It outlined a direct relationship between the energy we burn, the wealth we create, and the growth of greenhouse gas emissions. Now he's gone a step further with some new work, so Dr. Tim Garrett, welcome back to Radio EcoShock.
Thanks for having me.
I do appreciate you coming on the show, and I think we're going to learn something here today. I think we should start with your original formula for energy and wealth. Can you take a shot at explaining that for the intelligent listener?
Yeah, sure. I mean, it really started just as a simple query as to where the economic value comes from. And, you know, coming from a physics background and being really totally naive in economics, I thought, well, maybe it has something to do with the rate of energy consumption by civilization. In other words, perhaps that our wealth, the wealth of civilization, has a direct link to how much energy we can consume. To me, that seemed like a reasonable assumption, because in order for us to do anything, which I suppose is perhaps a measure of our wealth, we need to consume energy. That's a basic law of the physical universe. It is through energy transformations that anything happens. And so what I tried to do was just simply look at this using some available data, and it turned out that this relationship is in fact fixed, that there is a constant relationship of about 10 milliwatts that is required to support every inflation-adjusted $1990 of economic value. And that was the core result of the first paper I did into this, and what I tried to do is go from there to see what this implied for subjects such as global warming, which are closer to my primary field of research in atmospheric sciences.
Well, based on everything we know so far, if we grow the economy, as every politician promises, we'll put more greenhouse gases into the atmosphere. But what if the economy crashes? Will we put less up there, or will we reach safe levels if we have a severe downturn?
Well, this is where my work differed slightly from perhaps what other people are thinking. Now, the way I define wealth is that It is the accumulation of our past production of economic value. So what we have today is an accumulation of what we've been able to do in the past. Now, when you talk about the economy declining, well, usually what people think about is they think about GDP going down, the gross world product declining with time. And what I showed was that if the GDP declines with time, which is ordinarily what we would think of as being a depression, this would not, in fact, correspond to lower carbon dioxide emissions. In fact, carbon dioxide emissions would need to grow. Instead, in order for carbon dioxide emissions to go down, what would be required is effectively a complete collapse of the economy. A collapse in the sense that the gross world product would have to be almost completely offset by inflation. So that, in some sense, it would seem strange to an economist to think about this, but in some sense, the global product would have to be negative rather than positive. In other words, we'd have to be in a situation of net consumption rather than net production. We are consuming more of what we've produced in the past rather than producing new, increasing wealth. So that's a rather extreme situation, but this is what the data bears out as being required to have lower carbon dioxide emissions.
So if I understand it correctly, your definition of wealth does not include the sort of fantasy money that, like the quantitative easing from the U.S. Federal Reserve, but it includes everything that humans have produced that's still here from the beginning of time. I mean, even the Pantheon in Rome would be part of our accumulated wealth at this point.
Yes, yeah, that's a very good point. I mean, I part of my wealth is my house, but the house was produced back in 1926.
And you have a new paper submitted to the journal Climatic Change, and the title is On the Coupled Evolution of Inflation, Wealth, and Atmospheric Concentrations of Carbon Dioxide. And you do go a step further here, predicting, it seems to me, almost the worst of all worlds, high levels of greenhouse gases and inflation. I still don't really get what inflation has to do with climate change.
I was actually just down in New Orleans for a scientific meeting, and I spent some time after that with my family. And we went to some local museums, and of course in New Orleans, you know, there's the lasting legacy of the Hurricane Katrina disaster. And with Katrina, as it was with, you know, perhaps all natural disasters are, historically, they've been inflationary. What they do is they destroy past production while people perhaps still have the dollars in their pockets, but there are fewer things available for their dollars to be matched to, so the cost of what is present goes up in value. I mean, as it goes up in cost. Now, this wasn't actually how I approached it in the paper, but I think this was how an economist would normally approach the topic. The way I approached it in the paper was that I showed that environmental destruction, whether it's by disease or by weather or whatever it is effectively a decay on our past production that devalues what we have, and that is effectively an inflationary pressure. Now, what you can think about global warming being is, in some sense, it's like a long-term natural disaster. It is not only a long-term natural disaster that happens continuously, unlike Katrina, which was momentarily, but it also happens globally. So with Katrina, it was instantaneous, effectively instantaneous, and they caused a short-term inflation. But then people were able to come in from outside and provide new resources that stabilized the New Orleans economy. Now, I was in New Orleans, things were expensive still, but, you know, it wasn't out of this world. But in a future world, you can imagine, now this is slightly speculative, but it's consistent with what you would expect from the physics. You could imagine that there is an ever-increasing environmental pressure on civilization that continually acts as an ever-stronger force that eats away at what we have produced in the past. And this will be an inflationary pressure that cannot be supplanted by outside resources from outside, because it is acting globally. It will be affecting everybody.
Right. If we have rising seas, for example, eating up some of our best farmland or salinating it, there's just, you can't make some more land like that. It's gone.
Exactly.
So that pushes up the price of all the remaining land, and that's how climate change can create inflation, for example.
Yes.
This is Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith with Dr. Timothy Garrett, an atmospheric scientist from the University of Utah. And I'd like to really get to the conclusions of your new paper. Based on our past records of energy use and wealth, what does your model show as possible futures?
Well, in fact, I mean, this was actually stimulated by our past conversation. In my first study, I showed that carbon dioxide emissions and wealth were intrinsically coupled. Without actually decarbonizing the economy, like switching to renewables or nuclear power at an extraordinarily fast rate, you cannot have wealth without having carbon dioxide emissions. The two go together. And in fact, since 1970, the relationship between the two has been very, very tightly fixed. Now, that would seem to have implications for the future because carbon dioxide emissions accumulate in the atmosphere. As carbon dioxide emissions accumulate in the atmosphere, some fraction goes into what we call sinks in the oceans and the land, but about half of what we emit accumulates in the atmosphere. That is going to create an ever-increasing pressure on civilization. Now, by eating away at civilization wealth, global warming will actually reduce our capacity to emit carbon dioxide. So there's actually what you would call in physics a negative feedback. So our wealth is emitting CO2. CO2 accumulates in the atmosphere and then feeds back on our capacity to produce new wealth. Eventually, one could imagine that civilization would enter into a phase of collapse because the carbon dioxide levels are so high that we're simply unable to produce new goods without them being destroyed by global warming. And at that point, perhaps emissions would go down. And eventually, if civilization collapsed fast enough, then perhaps carbon dioxide concentrations would be stabilized. Now, you asked me last time what would be required to keep carbon dioxide concentrations at 450 parts per million. And that's normally what's considered to be about a dangerous level by, let's say, during the Copenhagen Accord. And I made a guess that it would require actually flat-out civilization collapse, and based on some preliminary work I did, and then I decided to look into this a bit more deeply, and I actually wrote a second paper where it turns out that is true. Not only would we have to have civilization collapse starting very, very soon, like within the next decade or so, but we would also have to have extremely rapid decarbonization in order to keep carbon dioxide levels below, let's say, 500 parts per million, twice pre-industrial levels. In order to keep them below 1,000, well, without civilization collapse, let's say we have continuing health, let's say that the civilization is very resilient to global warming, then carbon dioxide levels are going to go extremely high by the end of the century, probably above 1,000 parts per million. If you think about 1,000 parts per million, well, that's probably, depends on what the climate sensitivity is, but that's something along the lines of 5 degrees Celsius warming at least. And when we think of 5 degrees Celsius warming, people are familiar with this, usually start bringing up highly catastrophic scenarios. So in some sense, it's hard to imagine how civilization cannot be in pretty dire straits during this century.
Well, I hear people suggesting that we could make a big cut in carbon emissions just with energy efficiency. We'll all get electric cars and we'll put in the light bulbs. And I've heard that you don't think so much about energy efficiency as a way to save ourselves.
Well, actually, it's almost counterintuitive. But no, in fact, it's the other way around. The whole reason that civilization has been so successful and has grown so quickly is that we are energy efficient. It is our efficiency of taking material goods and energy and converting them into production and net growth that actually leads to us producing carbon dioxide. The increasingly efficient we become, the more efficient we become at growing civilization and its wealth. I think this is actually common sense. I mean, we always strive for efficiency because we have some underlying sense that efficiency is good for our general well-being. But our general well-being is normally measured in terms of economic wealth. And as I showed, economic wealth has a direct correspondence to carbon dioxide emissions. So increasing energy efficiency leads to more energy consumption, and more energy consumption leads to more carbon dioxide emissions. And I'm not the first person to say this. This has actually been pointed out by energy economists ever since the late 1800s. So I'm not sure why it's not more generally accepted today.
Just on a personal level, I have a camper van, but I don't drive it to Mexico anymore because I don't want to put all those carbon emissions up there. But if it got 100 miles to the gallon, well, maybe I'd drive further. Is that the kind of thing we're talking about here?
Oh, of course, yeah. No, it's like the beer fridge in the basement. You know, I just bought one of those because my upstairs fridge is actually fairly efficient these days.
You know, the study of economy has been called the dismal science, and your paper might qualify for that title. The abstract reads, "There are no plausible thermodynamically supported solutions that avoid inflation rates less than 100% and lead to stabilized atmospheric CO2 concentrations within this century." To me, that says we either get worthless money or a dangerous atmosphere or both. Are these our choices?
I don't see any other options. I mean, I suppose what you could argue is that civilization could decarbonize, switch to renewables and nuclear power at such an extraordinarily fast rate that in some sense we decouple ourselves from the atmosphere. So in other words, we are able to keep consuming energy without affecting atmospheric composition. But even there, there's actually, I mean, in some sense it's rather amusing. Well, it's intellectually amusing at least, that decarbonizing civilization will actually not be as effective as one might expect. Now, decarbonizing civilization, let's say we were to do this proactively, presumably it would cost money, and we would only do it with the expectation that it would help alleviate the worst damages of global warming. And I think that makes sense. You know, why would we do it otherwise? We would put in the effort because it will benefit us in the long run. But remember, anything that benefits us in the long run is effectively measurable as an increase in our wealth. And an increase in our wealth will translate to an increase in energy consumption. So, in essence, what happens is decarbonizing promotes our wealth and our energy consumption in the future. But increasing our energy consumption, as long as we are partly a fossil fuel economy, will correspond to increasing fossil fuel carbon dioxide emissions. So that doesn't completely offset the decarbonization gains, but because it promotes society health, we actually do not gain as much from decarbonizing as one might initially expect, because it's a dynamic system and we would actually continue to grow faster than we would otherwise.
I can see it. I mean, if we build a lot of nuclear power plants, it's going to take some carbon shovels to get all that cement going, and all the materials still have to be brought out. We're going to use oil to do it, and so there might actually be a burst of new emissions just trying to do that.
Well, yeah, that's that too, yes.
Mm-hmm. Well, recently I recorded a speech by the former Whole Earth catalog guru, Stuart Brand. He calls for an all-out effort to geoengineer the planet to stave off a climate disaster. He likes the idea of making clouds brighter by shooting seawater into them. That's supposed to reflect more sunlight, hoping to cool the Earth. You are a scientist with expertise in clouds. What do you think about that?
I'm quite skeptical that that would work. I mean, geoengineering is, in some sense, it may be a question not whether we should do it, but perhaps when we will do it. Because one could imagine that civilization will always try to do whatever it can to optimize its capacity to grow. But with regards to brightening clouds, well, that's been suggested as perhaps a viable way of doing it. One popular way that's been suggested is to produce lots of sea spray from some fancy ships. This sea spray goes up into the clouds, and that makes them brighter because if there are lots of small aerosol particles, these sea salt particles, then there will be more droplets in the clouds and also smaller droplets. And that has two effects. One is that, for some reasons I won't describe, it makes the clouds brighter, just by having a large number of small droplets, you have brighter clouds and clouds that have a small number of large droplets. But it also tends to shut off precipitation in the clouds. And because precipitation is a sink, it's a means for losing water from clouds, it has been argued that the clouds will have longer lifetimes and therefore reflect more sunlight to space for a longer period of time, and because they're brighter, they'll reflect more. These ideas have been around since the 1970s and 1980s, and it has since become apparent to a lot of researchers in this area that the effect is not nearly as strong as one might initially expect. There are all sorts of, again, negative feedbacks. And these negative feedbacks often act to entirely erase the brightening effect that you might expect from these aerosols going into the clouds. I mean, just to give one example, the clouds that would be targeted are these large sheets of stratus clouds and stratocumulus clouds that are off the western coasts of continents. So where you are, I guess you're in Vancouver, are you? You're probably very familiar with low-level clouds. I used to live in Seattle, and it was, you know, in Seattle, it's the entire winter was covered with this large deck of low-level clouds. Now, these clouds, if we brighten them, then they tend to be over the ocean. If we brighten them, then less solar radiation comes in to heat up the surface. And it is warming of the surface that enables the fluxes of moisture and heat from the oceans and the surface upwards into the atmosphere that enable the clouds to form in the first place. So let's say the clouds become brighter, they cool the surface, then there's less flux of heat and moisture to form the clouds, and then the clouds dissipate. So it could be that adding aerosols to clouds does not make them brighter and more long-lived, but actually shorter-lived and darker.
You know, you're kind of a troublemaker in a way here. Because we've got a lot of people who are looking for a realistic way out of this awful dilemma, and you've got a really sharp mind that seems to be you can stick some pins in the balloon and away it goes. But I guess that really is what science is about. I mean, we're looking for what is real and what works and what doesn't.
Oh, of course. I mean, you know, these are these are interesting physics problems, and I mean, one of the privileges of being a university scientist is, of course, that, I don't know, you get to think about these problems for the simple joy of thinking about them. And if the answers end up one way or rather than the other, well, that's well, so be it. I mean, it's the joys in trying to figure something out. Yeah, I mean, that's for me, that was the fun of doing the economics problem. I mean, I have no background in economics, but I am as much a player as anybody else in the economic system. And wouldn't it be fun if it is possible to understand the economic system using the tools that, well, I, as a physicist, understand from my research in doing clouds?
Well, as we've just found out, the economists don't understand the economy either. Look, our guest has been Dr. Timothy Garrett, Associate Professor, Atmospheric Sciences at the University of Utah. He's been researching the relationships between energy, wealth, and greenhouse gas emissions. Tim, people seem really enthusiastic about your work, even though it shows us playing right into some kind of end game. Isn't that strange?
You know, I don't know how much enthusiasm there really is, but I mean, it's you know, I think that in a lot of ways, people have some sort of hunch that things like energy efficiency actually leads to more energy consumption. And we hear this, you know, repeated mantra that it leads to less energy consumption. But I think, you know, we always think that energy efficiency increases our ability to lead wealthy, happy lives. And I don't know, wealthy, happy lives tends to correspond to increased energy consumption. So I think, you know, some people are just more receptive to really fairly intuitive, obvious ideas. And perhaps in another perspective, you know, maybe this is a very cynical statement, but if things really truly are hopeless, well then, you know, we don't have to worry as much. We can just enjoy the present.
Let's party like it's 1999. Well, thank you so much for sharing your time with us, Tim
Garrett. Thank you very much.
I'm Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock.
I was dreaming when I wrote this, so sue me if I fell too fast.
This is Radio EcoShock.
Oh my God! Breaking up!
As you've heard, there are big changes in the Arctic. The temperature is going up rapidly. Sea ice and glaciers are melting. The permafrost is giving way. That's why I was excited to get out and record the latest in a speech called Drivers of Environmental Change, The Case of the Arctic. The speaker was a polar veteran, Marie-Francoise André, of the University of Blaise Pascal, Clermont-Ferrand, France. I welcomed the opportunity for a European perspective, known for climate science leadership. As I listened, my head began to quietly explode. The latest science was missing, the old refrains of denial emerged, and another roomful of college students was misled about climate science, I think. How could this happen again? I didn't see any brochures for oil companies lying about. The lecture series appears to be funded by the Liu Institute for Global Issues, which is relatively progressive. I believe this lecture represents yet another current of discontent among scientists whose work has been overshadowed by the spotlight on climate change. So we'll give it a few minutes for others who run into this strange twist and those influenced by it. You can recognize the symptoms. Over her career, Dr. André has made 19 field expeditions to the Arctic and Antarctic. How could she deny the major changes there, obvious to the naked eye? She does not. A good part of this lecture, given October 28, 2010, consisted of slides showing massive changes in ice fields, sea ice, and glaciers. The warming is obvious. André is not a climate denier. She questions whether the changes are consistent with human-induced climate change and whether we will really see significant impacts, such as rising seas. I did learn from Dr. André. For example, I did not realize the huge extent of frozen ice under the northern continents holds so much of the world's fresh water. Let's hear just a bit about the permafrost.
You have on the right the hidden ice, I mean the permafrost ice, the ground ice, which covers much space in Arctic and subarctic regions. Permafrost occupies 50% of Canada, 60% of Russia, and 85% of Alaska.
Amazing. And with rapid Arctic warming, all this land will eventually thaw, releasing vast amounts of water vapor into the atmosphere, where it is a global warming gas, and massive runoff into the rivers and oceans, adding to rising sea levels. Most of the structures, pipelines, homes, and forests will be destabilized as this underground ocean of ice melts. Dr. André did not discuss this. Just to give you a flavor of the Canadian concern, here's a short clip from the CBC, Maria Tremonti, in 2006.
Well, climate change is affecting not just the weather and the ecosystem, but the landscape itself, right down to the very foundation of the tundra, permafrost. The word conjures up images of bleak, treeless stretches of frozen muskeg, but permafrost is losing its permanence in much of the Arctic, and as it melts, new phenomena like landslides on Ellesmere Island and rapid erosion of Arctic coastlines are occurring at alarming rates.
We learned that there are human-caused changes in the Arctic, all right, even though only 4 million people live within the Arctic Circle. She tells us about the localized impacts of settlements, especially the old Russian factory cities, and the growing impact of Arctic tourism on the delicate plant life. I cannot seriously equate these with the vast melting of the polar worlds, but it gives us a clue to André's motivations, in my opinion. Dr. Marie-Francoise André is not a climatologist. Like the host for this series and her co-author in a book, the Canadian scientist Olaf Slaymaker, Marie-Francoise is a geomorphologist. According to Wikipedia, quote, "Geomorphology is the scientific study of landforms and the processes that shape them, and more broadly, the evolution of processes controlling the topography of any planet. Geomorphologists seek to understand why landscapes look the way they do, to understand landform history and dynamics, and to predict future changes through a combination of field observation, physical experiment, and numerical modeling," end quote. Geomorphology is often placed within geography. It seemed evident, to me at least, that Dr. André is one of several disciplines who see more media, more research money and equipment going to climate science, while their important contributions are passed by. We do know from the work of Canadian scientists that climate events, such as the major sea ice melt and heating of 2007, can radically reshape the geomorphology of the Arctic. On one Canadian island studied, old rivers were blocked as whole landscapes slipped down hillsides over the melting ice below. These big changes likely happened across the whole Canadian North in that one season alone. That is large-scale change from Arctic warming, which cannot be compared to the foot traffic on Svalbard trampling plants. These lesser influences, championed by Dr. Andre, should not be ignored. The Arctic is fragile, and we need to protect that environment, just as she says. But Andre is critical of the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change. As it sounded to me, she suggested, the IPCC has been taken over by something like a cult. In particular, she laments the loss of the medieval warm period, as shown on a graph presented by the IPCC back in 1990. That assessment was later replaced by the famous hockey stick graph produced by Dr. Michael Mann. Dr. Andre tells the students,
there is now a view which is in between, before the first one and Mann's one, and there were many articles saying that the medieval optimum had been stolen, and suddenly, well, there is a kind of revival. It's what I mean is that if IPCC in this group, you have some people or some groups of people who are very powerful, and they provide a vision, their vision, and now, after this, it was something of a mess, I mean, after the report, now there are different views which are offered, but what is important to us is it's that finally the medieval optimum, the fact that the Middle Ages climate was a bit warmer than ours, is again admitted. Well, let's say that the debate continues and will continue for some time, I am afraid. So you can see the problem. Some people say if the climate was warmer in the Middle Ages, probably it's not because we pollute the atmosphere that the present climate warming exists. So you can see the implications behind. So one can understand why it's difficult.
As Joe Rahm often says in his blog, climateprogress.org, you have to put your head in a vise to continue with this kind of logic. Contrary to the impression given by Andre, Dr. Mann did not use just tree ring data to construct his graph. Studies from all over the world, including such things as coral and ice cores, show the European warming around the year 1000 was probably a local event, possibly caused by a change of ocean currents. It was not a globally experienced warming, as far as we can find out. The medieval globe was not warmer than today.
The Vikings. Talk to a climate denier long enough, and he's sure to start telling you about the Vikings. The climate deniers love the Vikings. They love to talk about some long-forgotten halcyon era when happy Vikings lived in a lush Greenland, celebrating a benign, warm period of prosperity and happiness. It's an article of absolute faith among climate deniers that 1,000 years ago the whole planet was warmer than today, and that the current warming is just part of a grand cycle mediated by the sun or some other mechanism.
You must see Peter Sinclair's Climate Denier Croc of the Week on medieval warming, found on YouTube. Find that link in my blog for this show at ecoshock.info. The American National Academy of Sciences was asked by Congress to investigate Dr. Mann's work. They found the new IPCC map of climate over time was accurate. The hockey stick graph, which shows the present is much, much hotter than the medieval warm period, stands. It has been cross-checked by the Academies of Science worldwide. The French Academy of Science stands behind it, as Marie-Francois knows well.
Most of what I said was dealing with the warming trend, which is the main mainstream. What most of the people say, at least the most influential people, but many people. And some others have a completely different view. Some predict and even already observe a cooling trend. They describe a cooling trend that would have begun either in 1990 1998 or in 2002, and they say that we are at the beginning of a cooling period like the one we experienced in the 1950s and 60s.
After puckishly suggesting the world might be cooling and showing us a graph supposedly showing cooling over the past 10 years, Dr. André admitted, after my question, that nobody in France talks about global cooling anymore. So why does she tell students it is a possibility? In the face of NASA data showing the first years of this century to be among the hottest ever recorded, year after year, after 30,000 French people died in the massive heat wave of 2003. Dr. André uses Peter Ward's new book, The Flooded Earth, literally as a poster boy for alarmists. Against all the recent findings by top European and American institutes, which warn of a minimum 5-foot sea level rise this century, André doubts sea level will rise, well, hardly at all. She explains this is because more snow is piling up on Greenland and even more on eastern Antarctica. This extra snow will absorb both the expansion of the oceans and the melting ice. She does not tell students that hard data from the American GRACE satellites refutes this theory. The satellites measure changes in gravity, showing a big loss of ice mass on both Greenland and, surprisingly, even in the coldest parts of Antarctica. André said nothing about recent polar science from NASA, NOAA, MIT, the National Academy, or the Geophysical Union. The data presented stopped at 2007. She plainly preferred the chart from the 1990 IPCC report. All through, we heard some say, and veiled accusations that climate critics had to hide carefully behind their words. It felt like we were at a secret meeting of apostates. I wanted to demand half an hour to refute, a chance to explain to the students that a boatload of expert science contradicted André's suggestions about the Arctic. But I was just a guest, allowed to record a speech. Only two questions were asked, and then people filed out of the room, turning on their iPods and iPhones. This series at St. John's College, part of the University of British Columbia, is designed to explore uncertainty about climate change. It ends next spring with Canada's own science doubter, Dr. Vaclav Smil. He told Andrew Revkin of the New York Times there has been no global warming in the past 10 years. He must have been away during the past decade on some other planet. Bring your own head vice for that one. I won't be there. I'm Alex Smith.
You can feel this, the chunk that we're on, actually starting to fail a bit more. Probably hairline cracks up the towards the helos there.
So does that mean we should back up?
Not yet. You can always jump over a crack. The power is just, it's unstoppable. There's no mechanical system you could really design to live through a thing like this. The forces are just stunning.
Check out the Radio EcoShock website. We're at ecoshock.org.
She said, "What is his story?" And he said, "His story is an angel being blown backwards into the future." He said his story is a pile of debris, and the angel wants to go back and fix things, to repair the things that have been broken. But there's a storm blowing from paradise, and the storm keeps blowing the angel backwards into the future. And this storm, this storm is called